Welcome to episode 418 of the Entertainment 2.0 podcast, brought to you by the Digital Media Zone. I'm Richard Gunther, and this is the show where we talk about Microsoft Entertainment technology, including audio, video, gaming, and more across all Windows platforms. Josh isn't here this week, but we have a special guest and a special episode for you with Jared Newman, writer for TechHive and other outlets. Jared, I'm glad you could join us. We're going to have a really good discussion about cord cutting, but before we get there, I have a quick feedback item from Kevin. Kevin was in our Mixer stream last week. We're actually not doing that live this week, but he mentioned that we had pretty terrible video issues and was wondering what was up with our Mixer stream. Josh actually believes that this was an issue with his computer, and he's trying to figure out how to resolve it. We think we'll get it resolved by the next time we're on, which should be next week. But stay tuned to find out when that's going to be. And along those lines, Kevin also mentioned that he doesn't use Facebook or Twitter, so he can't depend on those to know when we'll be live. So Josh suggests that the best thing that you could do there is subscribe to us on Mixer, and you'll be notified when we go live. Now, that doesn't necessarily give you advance notice, but it will at least give you a chance to join the stream before we start recording. Now, we also get a lot of feedback from Paul. I'm going to hold off on that because Paul asked a lot of good questions, and we're probably going to spread them over a few episodes. But I'd like Josh on the show for that because I think he and I can have some good discussion about these questions. So thank you, Paul. We will get to those in future episodes. Right now, let's get to our discussion about cord cutting. Jared, how are you doing?
Doing pretty good, Richard. How are you doing?
I'm doing really well. We have been teasing that we wanted to talk about cord cutting as a feature topic in the show. And we've also kind of teased that it would probably be you that we'd be talking with about this. Because you kind of are one of the big voices in this space right now out there in the tech media. And you have a really good perspective of what's going on just in general across the whole space. So I'm glad that we have the time to talk today, and we're just going to dive into kind of like, I would guess, like a state of cord cutting today. You know, we've been talking about cord cutting for, geez, years. And even before we lost Media Center, as it were, on the Microsoft side, a lot of people were looking for ways of getting on-demand content through streaming sources and trying to integrate that into their Windows devices. Of course, when the Xbox One came out, they promoted it heavily as a video streaming device. That didn't go over as well as Microsoft would have hoped. And they ended up making it more of a gaming box that, oh, by the way, it does streaming. So our listeners are very familiar with the types of things that you can do, but I don't know that everybody's yet ready to cut the cord. As an example, I'm not a cord cutter. I have all the cords. I have cable. I have subscription services. I have an antenna. I'm doing every wire that I can get into my house to get content. That's not necessarily where everyone's going, but there's so many options now, I think, for people who just don't want to pay for cable TV anymore. So that's what we'll talk about. And I wanted to basically just start with, I guess, the numbers. You know, the last that I heard, and I think this was probably the end of last year or summaries of 2016 viewers, that the majority of households still had cable. And I'm wondering if that's still the case. Are we at a point where that's tipped yet?
I think definitely the majority still do. I'm not sure exactly what the numbers are, but I really don't think it's anywhere close to tipping point in terms of majority don't. But we are at a tipping point where there is continuous, steady losses of subscribers in the pay TV industry. Last quarter, which is a historically bad quarter anyway for pay TV, they lost close to 1 million subscribers total.
Wow.
So, I mean, you know, the peak is sort of in the 100 million household range. And so now they're losing. And I think I always also think of like ESPN as sort of a good barometer for where things are. And
I feel so bad for ESPN.
I don't. But I think it was something like 12 million subscribers down from their peak, which was 4 years ago or something. So yeah, there's pain in the industry, which, as sad as that is, on some level, it is prompting change, and that's why you're starting to see all the new streaming services come out that you're seeing now.
Well, and streaming is nothing new, right? I mean, like I was saying, even back in the Media Center days, we had Netflix built into Media Center. Hulu existed, and they had a desktop app at the time that a lot of people wired into their home theater PCs. And even, you know, we've even seen streaming services come and go. Vongo comes to mind. I think that lasted about 2 years before it fell off, and it was probably too early for its time. It was probably trying to do something that people weren't quite ready for yet. But nowadays, it seems like everybody understands the concept of streaming, and everybody is probably not fair. But seriously, I know grandparents that have Roku boxes. The 80-year-old people that we bought the house that I live in now from had a Roku box in their kitchen. Right, so yeah. That's just fascinating to me.
Yeah, I mean, everybody has internet now. It's just part of life. And so, yeah, I think, you know, streaming is not new, but, you know, Netflix started streaming video in, was it 2007 or 2008? I think it took a lot of time for that just to become the kind of an established pattern. And they kind of led the way, and Hulu led the way, and YouTube led the way. And they sort of laid the groundwork for, you know, the Hollywood media companies saying, oh, you know, now we're it's not people cutting the cord. It's people that are growing up and they're just never getting cable to begin with. They don't see the point. So you're seeing efforts to capture that audience, but you can't really contain it that way. So you're seeing a lot of sort of blurring lines, you know, trying to get the cord nevers, as it were, to sign up for some of these new services. But that's getting more people to get rid of cable TV. So it's all happening very quickly now, which is why you're starting to see those numbers drop.
I think it's also really interesting to look at a shift in a lot of these providers. You mentioned Netflix and Hulu. Amazon's probably the other big gorilla. And the three of them all started really with licensed content that they made available either for purchase or for streaming, in the case of Hulu and Netflix. And then they started making their own content. So it's become more than just, oh, here's a place where you can come to get your ABC show or this movie that you want to see or whatever else. But now they have original content too. And that seems like a really big shift, and something that can, you know, frankly, finally compete with the networks that have the stronghold in cable.
Yeah, well, you really, again, have to give Netflix a lot of credit for that, because that was, I want to say it was 2009 or 2010, where they made that deal to get House of Cards. It was you know, a couple of years before the show was available on Netflix, and that was their first big move into, you know, premium television. It was, I think maybe they had dabbled in original content before, or going to, but yeah. this was a show where they were bidding for the rights against other major networks, and they put a lot of money into it. And that was a hedge against exactly what is happening now, which is, you know, a studio like Disney saying, oh, we're going to pull our stuff off Netflix, or, you know, I can't think offhand who else is doing that. But, you know, I think a lot of these studios in Hollywood are saying, well, we were licensing our stuff to Netflix for cheap because nobody else wanted it. And now they're saying, well, maybe we want it, or maybe we should be charging Netflix more for it, or maybe we should shop it around to Hulu or shop it around to Amazon. So to Netflix's credit, they realized that was going to happen a long time ago, and they started investing in building their own content, building a brand around that.
And in fact, you know, Netflix's rate hikes a couple years back were really a direct response to that, where they had great deals in advance of this becoming popular. And then once everybody else wanted to do this, and once people saw that this was lucrative, they really needed more revenue to support the licensing fees that content providers were then asking for or demanding. The other thing that I think is interesting, you know, you mentioned Disney, that, you know, that both frustrates me and delights me, because as a person who already gets confused by things on different services and wondering where everything is and still frustrated by the experience of trying to blend it all together, and we'll talk about that a little bit more later, I'm also a Disney stockholder. So I realize that there's probably some advantage to them in controlling the experience. I hope there is, except historically, and I talked with Josh about this last week, you know, historically, if you look at what the camera manufacturers did, every camera manufacturer initially rebelled against the community photo sites that existed out there because they wanted to own the experience. They wanted to be the place where you put your photos and they'd make them available to you. And Canon and every other manufacturer of cameras had their own special place for your photos. And even Kodak failed at that. They all folded basically and couldn't sustain it. So I worry about every studio, every content provider trying to do their own thing, because I wonder, is everyone going to be able to sustain it? Disney, I have little doubt that they're going to be able to sustain it, because they're Disney and they're already doing on-demand movies probably better than most other people are right now. However, you know, we have CBS as another example. CBS, you know, Uncle Les has decided that his content is way more valuable than what ABC, NBC, and Fox have to offer. So he's not giving it to Hulu. If you want to see what's on CBS, you have to pay another $6. Is that, and so, you know, we don't know what Disney is going to charge. We know what it costs for Hulu and Netflix. We now have another $6 for CBS, ABC and FX, AMC and FX have recently come out with their own additional paid services. Is this ultimately going to end up being just as expensive as having a cable service? Is this a financially sound decision for someone to say, you know, I can live without the cable TV service. I just need these things. And do these things end up adding up to what they pay in cable?
Well, I think it's worth kind of making a kind of a distinction, or at least kind of clarifying what these things are, right? So specifically with Disney, you know, they're creating a service that's at least supposed to be supplemental to what they offer on cable. And, you know, there was a lot of hemming and hawing about them pulling their stuff out of Netflix, but that deal was signed in 2012 and it only started last year. So it's, right. You know, Netflix has been around for years. Nobody had Disney movies on Netflix and nobody cared. But it's nice to have them for the last year, but it's not like all of a sudden Netflix isn't viable anymore because there's not Disney movies on it. That was a new development.
Actually, I don't know if you remember this or not, but early Netflix did have Disney movies, and Disney ended up taking them and saying, yeah, you know what? We're going to give them to HBO and Stars for a while instead. And then eventually came back to Netflix. So I kind of feel like Netflix has already weathered this storm, and turns out they did okay.
Yeah, and, you know, Stars pulled their stuff off of Netflix a while ago, and I think Netflix survived that okay. People were freaking out about that at the time. Now, if we talk about, like, what AMC and FX are doing, that's also, I mean, that's the same content as cable. They're charging for an ad-free service, which is just a separate thing. And you know, I think they're charging too much. I'd be surprised to see people subscribe to that. But I do like the idea of these companies sort of creating a ad-free business model. You know, it's sort of following along with what Hulu did last year or the year before, where they added an ad-free model. And everybody is generally happy to see that happen. Yes, it costs more. But
that was an easy $3 to pay. No problem.
No problem. So, you know, let's say you know, you have your get your streaming bundle through Hulu or through whoever, Sling TV. And now there's a business model where maybe Sling can say, you want to do ad-free for all these channels? Pay us a little extra and we'll do it for all the channels that we have that are offering this feature. You know, I don't see any problem with that. You know, you want to deal with DVR, you can do that too, but you got to pay extra for that too. So, you know, I like the Netflix model of just not having to worry about ads, not having to worry about DVR. And the rest of the industry is now taking steps towards that. So that's fine with me.
So you just went to two additional service areas that I absolutely want to talk about. There's on-demand streaming, which we're all familiar with. Mm-hmm. And that can be a combination of current content like Hulu has, catalog content like Netflix has, a combination of those two, original content. Then we have companies like Sling, like Hulu, like YouTube, like Sony. They're putting together these alternatives for live TV viewing packages. Talk a little bit about what those offer and maybe, you know, what they might be lacking. Is a package of live TV channels from one of those providers kind of equivalent to what you might get from your cable provider? Do you get your locals? Do you get your sports? Stuff like that?
First, if it's allowed, I want to go back and go back to what we were talking about just before to complete one thought that came into my head, and that's this. So we've
sure.
So we've established that the AMC and Fox is kind of a separate thing. It's just an ad-free sort of supplement. We've established that you know, Disney is kind of doing this extra thing, kind of a premium thing. I think CBS also, they're fashioning CBS All Access as this kind of premium thing. And Netflix is kind of like that too. I think the point is, and it could be kind of trite, but you don't need all of those things in the same way that, like, if you had cable, you don't need HBO and Showtime and Stars and Cinemax. Maybe you just want HBO, or maybe you don't need any of them. These are, you know, premium channels, and maybe you can be fine without all of those, and you can pick and choose, even if you have sort of a basic bundle. So that maybe ties into your next question, which is about...
See, that's my problem, Jared. Just like I have all the cords, I have all the channels, because I might miss something. FOMO.
Yeah, so if you want to pay for a ton of TV, that's good for you, and congratulations on spending all that money. And watching all that TV, that's cool. I don't have a problem with that. But I'll talk about your streaming bundle question now. I guess I would say what I've always said is that they're a transitional step. They're not doing that great. They're doing okay, but they're not stopping the decline in traditional pay TV subscriptions. So if you lump those in with, you know, cable and satellite, it's still industry decline. And the reason is because it's just, you know, it's still a lot of money. It's still people who are growing up with Netflix or Amazon Prime or Hulu are still not seeing the point in paying for all those channels. And if you're coming from cable, there are still kind of things that you are maybe frustrated with. You know, the way that DVR works, this, you know, PlayStation View is... You have 28 days to watch your DVR recordings. Hulu is, your recordings are there forever, but some of them won't let you skip the ads. Sling TV is, you know, they're there forever, but you only have 50 hours, and it's $5 a month extra just for that. YouTube TV also has a restriction against ad skipping, and it's 9 months to watch whatever. So there's, you know, there's things like that that you have to deal with. On the other hand, you know, they're cheaper than cable. They're just generally cheaper than cable. I mean, there are some instances where if you have a really good bundle offer from your cable subscriber, you may do pretty well, especially in those like early years where they're giving you a promo rate. But
right.
You know, if you're paying $30 or $40 or $50 a month for one of these bundles, it's going to be cheaper than the average $100 a month that consumers are paying. So, you know, it's kind of a messy path to cutting cable and saving some money, but it's not as drastic as just going for standalone streaming services.
Now, one of the things that I think I've heard is that their carriage of local TV channels may vary by locale or service. So depending on what service you subscribe to and where you're living, you may or may not be able to get your local TV channels for or as part of one of these live TV bundles. Is that correct?
That is correct. So basically, you know, to offer live local channels in a given market, the streaming service has to have a deal with the local affiliate station. So, you know, there's some stations that are owned by the networks. So in most of those cases, the local channels are available. That was no problem. And then it became a question of, you know, how do you get these affiliate providers to play ball? And so there have been some things this year that started to happen. Several of the networks, I think at this point, it's NBC, CBS, and ABC have all sort of reached these broad agreements with their affiliate stations. It's sort of a template by which they can make their feeds available for the streaming bundles. So you're starting to see now a lot of these channels coming online. It's not everywhere yet, but I feel like every week now I'm seeing a story where it's like PlayStation View added 20 CBS channels or DirecTV Now added 20 Fox channels. So I think my gut feeling is sort of like by the end of the year, it's going to be in most cases you can get those local channels. But it has taken a while to get there because that issue has been in place. Yeah.
Okay. Now I also want to talk about the DVR service you mentioned, because each of these services does have some sort of DVR or recording capability. And I really hope that they have it in their agreements that they're allowed to not actually have to warehouse individual copies of things that you record for you, but that's beside the point. I am really curious, though, has this evolved to the point that it is kind of usable yet? Because I remember stories when Sling TV first introduced this, and I think they were the first, where some channels you could record, some you couldn't. Some channels you could record and skip commercials, and some channels you could record but couldn't skip commercials. Some channels you could record, but the recording only stayed around for a shorter period of time than other channels. So where has the dust settled on that yet?
Yes and no. So as like I was saying before, you know, each service has their own limitations. So the 28-day limit is Sony's service. And as far as I know, there's no ad skipping restrictions. I did hear a report that some people's DVR recordings were getting replaced with on-demand episodes, which had unskippable commercials. And I'm not sure if that was happening a lot or if it was a glitch or something. So that is a thing. But Sling is supposed to let you skip ads. And you're right, they didn't have all the channels at first supporting DVR. And now it's all of them except Disney-owned channels. So no ESPN and no Disney and no... Yeah. So there is that. And then Hulu and YouTube TV have the ad-skipping restriction. And I think that was sort of the deal they felt that they had to make to get all the channels on board and to be able to have whatever, you know, storage conditions they wanted. So, yeah, I think all of them have had to make these tough decisions to get DVR rights from the channels. Which is sort of going back to what I was saying, like, this is why these things are imperfect and why they're sort of a transitional step toward more Netflix-like services that just get that friction out of the way.
Well, and I think it's a little bit ironic because I have to imagine that the executives at Sling, the executives at Sony, figured that they were well-positioned enough in the industry that they could perhaps get rid of that friction, that they could do better deals and be able to make this a better experience than what you get with your normal cable TV provider. And they probably ended up having to go to the same negotiating tables. And, you know, you read the stories about how, no, you can't get Disney Channel unless you also get Disney XD and you also get Disney this and you also get Disney. So they still had a lot of the, I guess, pushback from the providers that the cable companies are having to deal with too. So that's probably still going to be the case until somebody comes up with a model that everybody can live with. I don't know if I'll be alive when that happens.
Well, you still have the bundle dynamic. So you still have, you know,
right.
You still have ESPN, or Disney wants all of the ESPN channels. If you're going to carry Disney Junior, then you also have to carry ESPN. Or if you want to carry CNN, then you need to carry TNT and TBS and all the Turner stations. So that dynamic is still there. But you now have a market where there's, I think now it's five, let's see, Sling, PlayStation View, YouTube TV, Hulu with live TV, DirecTV Now, and if you count Fubo TV in there, that's six streaming bundles. So there's competition, and there's more competition than there's ever been before, and so there's price pressure. And so what happens is, Sling says, all right, you know what, Discovery, we don't want your channels. They're not worth the price. They're not worth raising prices for subscribers. They're going to make our service less attractive. So you could take a hike. And Sony did this, I think it was last year, with Viacom. They had Viacom channels in their bundle. And then they said, they basically announced, we're dropping Viacom channels, something along the lines of, to preserve a better value for our customers, or to maintain value for our customers, which is just a nice flowery PR way of saying, we don't want to raise prices. So we told them to take a hike. And that's, you know, that's good, because a lot of what led to cable bundles being outrageously expensive is there's not really a huge incentive not to raise prices. I mean, you did have some pushback from cable companies. You know, the network, ESPN would say, well, we had to pay, you know, billions of dollars for Monday Night Football, so we need more money to carry ESPN. And what's a cable company going to do? You know, they can't really drop ESPN. And so, you know, they pay the money. And so now there's a little bit more pressure, at least among channels whose content is not as on demand. And so you're seeing some of them get booted. And that's leading to things like Discovery saying, well, maybe we'll work with Viacom and AMC on a sports free bundle, and it's going to be less than $20 a month, and it won't have ESPN. And that's going to put pressure on ESPN to say, well, we'll have a bundle that's just Disney. You know, we'll do a Disney bundle, and we'll do a standalone ESPN bundle. So I think there's sort of this cascading effect now because there's competition.
Yep, yep. And that's good. We need that. We need that to happen.
Yeah, so slowly
now,
but surely.
Let's say that you're more technically inclined, like many of our listeners are, and you're willing to kind of stand up your own DVR instead of having to rely on services that someone like this provides. There are a number of online services and downloadable things that you can install that allow you to create your own kind of homegrown hybrid DVR. And you've reviewed recently the MB DVR, which frankly, I didn't even know existed. We're both Josh and I are Plex people, and we try to cover MB, but we weren't aware that they had a comparable DVR offering. HD Home Run, of course, has been, or rather Silicon Dust has been doing the HD Home Run DVR, a very serious enthusiast hobbyist kind of product at this point anyway. Are these, do you feel, like viable alternatives for people who want to get maybe their own DVR solution, either from over the air antenna broadcasts or from cable, even if they're still paying for that, or even in the case of things like Play on DVR, where, and I still don't know how this is legal, you're able to record content that you can get through streaming services.
Well, I mean, I think there's probably a ceiling to the audience for these things. If you think of if over the air DVR was, or you know, cable car DVR was super popular, then I think, you know, Amazon or Roku or, you know, maybe Apple would have done it by now. And, you know, Xbox, Microsoft thought about doing DVR. Remember, they came out with their TV tuner for Xbox, and then they said, we're going to do DVR for it. And then a few months later, they said, never mind, we're not going to do it.
Not oh, yeah. Demand. Oh, our listeners remember that vividly. We're still a little bit bruised by that.
I was bummed about that, too. So, you know, it's going to be a hobbyist thing, but there is kind of a proliferation in that, too. You know, Tableau is around. Tableau, I think, is still kind of the most user-friendly solution. But if you're really into video quality, you want to have high frame rates and surround sound, you can't, that's sort of a non-starter. So, but, you know, yeah, like you said, HD Home Run, the DVR product is, it's actually not even out yet. It's in like a beta. You could buy it, but it's like a beta product. But that's
any
there.
Year now, Jared, any year now.
You know, and then channel, like there's a bunch of guys that are doing a thing called Channels, which is based off HD Home Run, and it's for Apple devices. And I haven't tried their DVR product yet, but it's that their app is really slick. And now this Plex has their DVR is pretty compelling, and MB is pretty compelling. And so, and now you kind of have these options. It's not it doesn't seem like you have to make a huge compromise now. I'd gone through all these products, and I felt like none of them were really quite there yet. And now I feel like we're getting there. You know, now MB. It was funny because so a few months ago we published a roundup of DVR solutions, and I think I reviewed HD Home Run and Plex, Tableau, TiVo Romeo OTA, and ChannelMaster. So this is all over the air antenna DVR. And then we had a reader say, "What about MB?" And I actually, like you, didn't really realize that was a thing. So I checked it out, and it turns out that it's good. I mean, it's definitely like in the running with Plex. I don't think there's something about their apps that's not quite as polished as Plex.
Right.
And there's kind of grading, like you have to supply your own guide data. So that becomes kind of a weird thing. Like you have to have a separate subscription to this other service called Schedules Direct, or you can go down this rabbit hole of like finding your own guide data and making in some kind of XML file that you can import. It gets really messy, and like I'm pretty tech savvy and I couldn't really figure it out. So it's you know, yeah, Plex is like you pay us a subscription and we take care of it all. And MB was more like you still have to kind of figure some stuff out. But once you get all of them running.
You had mentioned that in MB the service that you need to pay for to get the guide data, or you can get it free through certain other services. That's in addition to what you're already paying MB to be able to use the DVR service. So it did seem like it was a little bit more involved. But I mean, the thing that caught me by surprise there also, you mentioned in your review, I believe, that MB actually produces something of a traditional guide to display the information for you. And Josh and I just kind of scratched our heads when we talked about that, because we know that that guide is licensed, and I find it very hard to believe that the folks behind MB actually have the money to pay the licensing fee to the nice folks at Rovio, now TiVo, to display it that way.
So I think you're conflating a couple of things. So the guide data, which is, you know, like you said, could be from Rovio or whatever. With MB, that's what you have to supply yourself.
Right.
So the easiest way is there's a nonprofit called Schedules Direct, and I don't know exactly what their deal is. Like you could become a Schedules Direct member, and they're a nonprofit, and they say when you become a member, we provide you with guide data. I don't really know how that works, but they get.
It's kind of like going into a bar in Utah, I think.
Okay,
you become a member of our club, and we'll serve you a beer.
Right. So exactly. So with MB, what you do is you plug in your Schedules Direct login into their software, and they populate their traditional grid-based TV guide view. You know, channel this time slot, this time slot, this time slot. You know, just like you'd get in a cable box. But the actual data you have to pay for and supply yourself.
Get it. That goes,
Plex gets the data as part of, you know, that's part of the rationale for charging a Plex pass to get their DVRs, that they have to pay for the guide data. Yep. And that's, and they've said to me, you know, I said, are you going to do like a free service of some kind for HD Home Runner for antenna tuners? And they basically said no, because we still have to pay for the guide data. So it's always going to be tied to Plex Pass pretty much. But what they don't have right now is that traditional cable like TV guide. And people get really attached to that, you know.
Oh yeah.
People do not like to watch TV without that guide. So
I still feel like for linear programming, it is the most efficient way of displaying information, maybe short of TiVo's two column guide. And I feel our understanding has been, from what we have learned in talking with different manufacturers, that guide, that presentation of information in that fashion, is patented by previously Rovi. I think they acquired it, and now that's TiVo. So I'm curious how anybody else is actually using that without paying that licensing fee. That is, in fact, why Silicon Dust did not intentionally provide the guide data for their DVR service in a traditional guide view.
Mm. Okay, so I apologize for misinterpreting you. I did not know that, and that is interesting, because Tableau has a traditional guide like that too, and I think, I mean, some of these streaming services are doing it. Sling TV recently added a guide, but they didn't
have
it
first. Well, you have to imagine that, I mean, clearly Sling TV is big enough to be paying any licensing fee associated with that, because of course they already, their sister company, if you will, is already doing it for the products that they make available. So I think I have to wonder if a lot of it has to do with just, they're just not big enough. You know, they're still flying under the radar, and
could be,
nobody really cares yet. Kind of like PlayOn. Clearly there are going to be some lawsuits there at some point if it gets big enough, but right now nobody's noticing.
They may not even know that that's an issue, you know, because I didn't know that was an that, issue.
that's a failure of our patent and trademark system. All right, so let's move off of DVR technology and talk about just hardware in general. Mm-hmm. Like, there are so many different devices out there for getting into streaming and on-demand content. And if you were recommending to your family member, a friend who's asking you, because, you know, we all have these people where, for them, we're their IT support. We're, mm-hmm. we're the people that they come to ask these questions. What would you recommend if someone's like, you know what? I've had it with cable. I just want to do streaming, and I don't know. I don't even know where to start. I don't know what box to buy. I don't know what... Mm-hmm. what dongle to plug into my TV. What do you recommend for folks?
So if you get a Tech Hive right now, the current thing we have in our roundup as like the best for most people is the Fire TV box. And I was sort of conflicted about that, just because it's not HDR. It's 4K, but it's not HDR. And so mm-hmm. there's got to be some kind of upgrade on the horizon. But that, you know, it was a few months ago already when I wrote it. It was probably even longer ago than that. But I think some of the ideas that they had about UI are really good, and they haven't totally been matched yet by the other players. I you use Fire TV, they really put an emphasis on the content as opposed to apps. You know, you go to the Fire TV home screen and there's stuff. You could just mess around and find something, and you'll probably just find something to watch, and you'll start watching it. Granted, a lot of that is from Amazon, but they've started opening that up recently. So now,
yep.
you know, there's Netflix on the home screen, and there's HBO on the home screen. And I just think that that's the way it should be. So that recommendation was sort of an opinionated take on like what streaming UI should look like. Mm-hmm. But I think we are seeing other players sort of catch up to that, you know. The upcoming Android TV update has a similar kind of home screen vibe, and Apple TV is kind of, they seem to be investing in that TV app as being the the central UI for watching video on Apple TV. Roku is still a little behind. They're still very much in that app paradigm. But Roku is very easy to use. So they kind of, you know, it's simple. The devices are cheap, and even the cheap devices run fairly quickly. So I'm sort of torn about it, but I think I would probably say Fire TV. And above all that, you know, if you're replacing whatever is in your main television, don't cheap out. Don't go for, like, the Roku stick or the Fire TV stick. Spend the extra $50 and get one of the nicer boxes that doesn't, you know, lag and have performance issues and isn't future-proof. Get yourself the nicer device. It's not that much more money. You're saving a lot of money by cutting cable anyway. Spend it the first time. Don't cry about it. You won't cry about it in the future. You'll be happy that you did. And so, and then you can maybe, for your secondary TVs, get a Roku stick or a Fire TV stick or something like that.
I think that's really good advice. No, I think that's really good advice, because I have experienced Roku through a box, and I've experienced Roku through a stick. And I can tell you, hands down, the difference is significant. And usually, from what I've found, the sticks, and this is actually literally true with the Roku, are a generation behind. And I'm curious if, like, the Amazon TV situation is the same. If the Amazon Fire TV stick is actually just kind of a lower processor than what you would see in a box, that would make a lot of sense, because why is it so cheap, right?
Yeah, it's a different class of processor, I think. So it's not just like they're taking last year's processor and they're just using an entirely different and lower end processor. Roku stick, actually, the 2016 model, I think the processor is similar to the Roku 3, which came out, you know, the year before. And it's right. That's actually decent. Like, it's not too bad. And the thing about Roku is that their software is supposed to be designed to run on lower end hardware. You know, much of Roku's business now is about getting onto smart TVs and maybe even, like, cable boxes in certain markets. So they want their apps to work on cheaper hardware. So, you know, it kind of works for them, but it kind of also, you know, it to some extent, it harms the experience. I think the quality of their apps, in some ways, has been behind other platforms. So it's sort of an issue for them. But for Fire TV, it really becomes noticeable. If you use an app that is pretty processor intensive, like PlayStation View or something like that, on the Fire TV, it's just very slow, hard to deal with. And that's why you want to use the box for your main TV, or possibly even other TVs around the house.
That makes sense. All right. Now, you've talked a little bit about experience and the difference between an app-centric versus perhaps a program-specific approach toward presenting information and content to users. This, from my perspective, is one of the biggest things. And, you know, I've been teasing this throughout this whole discussion, that I really want to talk a little bit about ease of use and fragmentation. And my biggest concern on this whole streaming issue, besides that you have to pay this person and this person and this person, is really that content's all over the place. And just from buying DVDs and having digital copies available through Blu-ray and 4K Ultra HD discs, some of it's on iTunes, some of it's on Vudu. In some cases, it's on both. In many cases, it's on one or the other. And so I already have this situation in my household, and our listeners are tired of hearing this, where I go away for a weekend and we end up buying something that's already on a service somewhere because we already own it. But there's no easy way of knowing that. So I'm very concerned that nobody's really solved the content discovery problem effectively, particularly as it relates not just to content that you can go and find, but content that you already own. And I almost feel like, just as there are conspiracy theorists that believe, and I'm going to get dark real quickly, that drug manufacturers really have no incentive to cure cancer because that would mean that they can't sell cancer drugs. I also feel like there may be no incentive for these device manufacturers to come up with a way of aggregating all this content in an easy to find way, particularly with regard to what you already own, because then maybe you won't accidentally buy it again.
I don't know about that. I mean, well, first of all, you know, the content ownership in streaming video is rapidly declining. So I think a Roku is not particularly concerned with having you deal with your ownership stuff in general. That's a job that maybe Plex could do, or MB, or, you know, your media server software should do that for you. I do think that there's not as much incentive for the streaming services to participate in aggregation, universal search, and universal browsing. But I don't think it's... I actually don't think that's as bad as it had been previously. I think some of those media companies are starting to realize that it behooves them to make their content discoverable through something like the TV app on Apple TV or something like the home screen on Fire TV. I think there are exceptions, like Netflix, you know, is maybe more sensitive and wants you to be in their app. They have a very opinionated view on like how their recommendations are served and don't want to cede that to anybody else.
Which is kind of surprising because they gave into TiVo.
In terms of what?
In terms of creating one pass programming for content, but they didn't give into the TV app. And I understand that that's partly a recommendation engine too, but the other great thing that the TV app does is it keeps track of what you're watching.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I wonder if the TiVo thing is patent related too, because there was a patent agreement recently between Netflix and TiVo. And I don't know if that was a renewal of an early agreement or what, but,
interesting.
Yeah. As far as the universal watch list thing goes, yeah, I think you'll see more of that. Google with Android TV, the next version is supposed to have some sort of system-wide watch list feature. And Roku has Roku Feed, which is it's a bit watch list like. It tells you when there's new episodes available of a show that you watch. So I think it's just a matter of getting the streaming services to participate in those things, and I think that they will. It's just you know, they have to kind of see the light on it, you know.
I hope that comes, because I think that's one of the biggest things that is making this experience more complicated than just having cable and a DVR.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I totally get it. I do. And I think, you know, there hasn't been enough content to really justify that previously.
Oh, come on.
Yeah, I do. I mean, you know, if you're talking about your library of stuff, sure. But I mean, you know, major media offering streaming services, I don't know. I guess if we're talking like TV everywhere apps, there's been a lot of those, but I don't think they're necessarily like, you know, thinking about those kind of things.
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely true. Absolutely true. All right. Well, one of the things that I'm really curious about, you know, you've been looking at this space for a long time and you've reviewed a bunch of different products. We've talked about a couple of different things in terms of hardware and services and Are there things out there that are kind of just like little surprises that people should be aware of that we might not have already talked about? Like, is there something out there that, man, if you haven't looked at this service, you totally should, because it's free and it's awesome and it's there and you should take advantage of it. We all know about YouTube already, though, so don't say that.
Yeah, no, there's a lot of like interesting free services out there. I mean, some of them are maybe more well-known now, like CBS News has a... It's basically like a 24/7 live streaming news app, and it's like anchored coverage a decent amount of the day. So if you want to just turn on the news, it's like a very nice app to have for that. And sort of related to that is Pluto TV. They've kind of created a cable guide looking interface. So I don't know why they haven't been sued yet, but they've created a great cable guide looking interface for streaming video. And it was, they started off actually kind of just like stringing together YouTube videos. And it had some interesting channels, like one dedicated to hockey fights and one dedicated to surfing videos. And I think they kind of veered a little bit more towards like branded, you know, like media properties that don't necessarily have their own streaming services, and they're trying to aggregate them. So that's kind of like an interesting source of like news and other entertainment that you might not find through the bigger streaming services. And there's all these other little ones like Red Bull TV, if you're into like extreme sports kind of stuff.
I've heard there's some really good content on there, actually.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's like easy to watch kind of stuff. And then there's Tubi TV, which they, I guess they've been doing more like anime, and they have their stuff. There's a lot of like, you know, the wheat to chaff ratio is low, but you can find some stuff there. So yeah, you look around and you can start to find some interesting stuff if you're willing to go off the beaten path.
Very cool. Yeah. So I have to ask the big question. Are you without cable? You go exclusively streaming?
Oh yeah. I got rid of cable in 2008.
Wow.
Yeah. I had
Dude, you're a pioneer.
Yeah, well, you know what happened was I had just moved to LA. I'm not in LA now, but I just moved to LA, and I didn't have a job. I was trying to get my freelance career started. And we had Netflix, and they had just started doing the streaming video, and like Hulu had just started doing their stuff, and YouTube was around, and I kind of knew about antennas somehow. I was like, oh yeah, I could get some stuff from the antenna. And it just seemed like an easy way to save money. I was not like a huge TV person, so I felt like it wasn't a huge sacrifice to get rid of cable. And so it's been pretty rewarding, like from that perspective, to just kind of see more options become available and be able to enjoy them without fretting about, you know, what am I missing? You know, because I don't feel like I'm missing anything. So yeah, I guess I've probably saved a lot of money over the years.
That's a really nice place to be. I'm on the opposite side of that. I have everything because I want access to everything. And in my opinion, the ideal streaming service wouldn't even have to have live TV. Like, I could deal with just over the air for stuff that I want to watch live, like news and stuff like that. But I feel like for me, I want access to, and I know this is never going to happen. Maybe by the time I'm dead, it'll happen. I want access to everything. I want the ability to pay a lump sum for an all-you-can-eat banquet. And I'm willing to pay. I mean, most people are like, oh, well, you know, I don't want to pay more than $20 or $30 a month. I'd pay $100 a month if I could get on-demand access to any show that ever existed that's available digitally after 24 hours from air.
Mm-hmm.
And that's essentially, I had hoped that that's what Apple would do, because that's essentially the catalog that Apple has amassed. The iTunes video library for TV content is essentially that. They have probably the most comprehensive set of content over the years across all of the different providers, except for, of course, custom content like Netflix and Amazon's in-house stuff. But that's kind of what I want, and I feel like I'll pay for it. I hate having to go to multiple places for it. That makes me crazy.
Yeah, but they would need to acquire. I don't think that their rights that they have for like a la carte sales would carry over to like an all-encompassing subscription service from every single media company spanning every single TV show.
Oh, I'm sure that they don't.
And then you get into a situation where, you know, the media companies aren't there yet. They don't have the rights to their own, you know, past, even the shows that they have on TV now, they don't necessarily have, you know, they say stacking rights of like a full season or back seasons. They need to, and I think you're starting to see them change that because they realize how powerful the Netflix model is to just have everything available forever. So I think you will see, you may not get everything, but, you know, I think they're starting to move towards, let's make more of it available to our subscribers. So I guess that might be like the flip side of your worries about fragmentation, I guess, is that each of these services, because it's going to control more of their own content, it can offer it in that sort of all-you-can-eat buffet fashion.
Okay, so there's hope.
There's hope.
All right, good stuff. Good stuff. Jared, thank you so much for this discussion. This has gone a lot deeper than I even thought that we would.
Sorry.
I'm so glad that we were able to that's a good thing. I'm so glad that we were able to have you on. Tell folks where they can find out more about cord cutting. I know you write for Tech Hive and a number of other outlets, and you have your weekly newsletter about cord cutting. Let people know how they can get to all that stuff.
Sure. So I write a weekly column on cord cutting for Tech Hive. It's called Cord Cutter Confidential, and it generally runs every Thursday. And I write for, so Tech Hive is a sister site of PC World and Mac World. So I also occasionally write for those websites. And I also write a little bit of news and some features for Fast Company, just on general tech stuff. And finally, I have a newsletter called Cord Cutter Weekly. It's been around for about a year now, and it has about 7,500 subscribers, and it's free, and it has a link to the weekly column, along with just some quick takes on the week's news and any noteworthy deals that I've found. So probably a very easy way to keep up with my cord cutting work if you want to do that.
All right, and we'll have links to that and to your column, of course. Again, thank you so much. This has been great.
Yeah, thanks, Richard.
Well, you can find us on Twitter as well. I'm at Richard Gunther. Josh is at Josh Pollard. And we collectively are at DG Media Zone, DIGI Media Zone. We're also on Facebook as the DMZ. Of course, we have our other show, Home On, which is a podcast about smart home technology in the DIY space. If that's something that's interesting to you, check it out. Our last episode features a discussion about the challenges facing the smart kitchen. As you probably know, we usually record live on Tuesdays at 8:30. Keep up with our social channels to know if that's going to change at all. That is going to do it for episode 418. I'm Richard Gunther, and our special guest this week was Jared Newman. Thanks for listening to Entertainment 2.0. And I'll channel my best Josh here as I say adios. Yeah, I just don't do that as well as he does.